Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Lisa Napoli. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, Gail Feldman. As a journalist, Gail has covered the publishing world for Publishers Weekly for decades and is a well-known figure in the industry. But she never imagined, when she began researching the man who created Random House, that she'd spend the next 24 years of her life ferreting out and stitching together his life story, as well as the expansive cultural history that unfolded alongside it. On the recent publication of her book, Nothing Random, Bennett Cerf and the Publishing House He Built, I asked her about this monumental achievement.
I knew Bennett Cerf when I was a kid and watched him on Sunday nights sometimes on What's My Line. And I knew that he was the founder of Random House, but I did not know the kind of life that he had had, which was a life where he knew everybody who was anybody, and where he had a level of energy that an article in the Times once compared to the energy of George Washington. So I had no idea of the scope of his life, or as one of his sons put it to me, the vast surface that it occupied.
I love how you describe it, a New York switchboard to the famous.
Yep.
Okay, so he's much more quote unquote interesting than you would think some guy publishing books might be. And then all of a sudden you stumble on this archive. How did that happen?
I had a fellowship at the Columbia Journalism School.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing a project comparing best-selling books with prize-winning books, and I actually published a 100-page monograph. I stumbled upon the fact that the Random House archive and Cerf's personal archive and lots of publishing archives were at Columbia. I wrote one article during the year of the fellowship because I loved doing publishing history pieces, and this was a book that had been published for the 75th anniversary of Modern Library. And it was a collection of the wartime letters of Bennett Cerf and his lifelong business partner and best friend, Donald Klopfer.
Mm-hmm.
The letters were wonderful. They were funny, charming. They showed the enormous love that these men had for each other. And I suddenly thought, my God, through Bennett Cerf's life, you could tell the story of 20th century publishing and so many other stories.
Yes.
And I did a proposal towards the end of my fellowship and sent it to the Random House editor I had interviewed, who was responsible for the letters, and wrote to him and said it would be a conflict of interest for Random House to publish this book, but do you think this is on the right track, this proposal? 2 days later, he phoned me and said, I'm going to publish this book, and I've sent you a proposal to Christopher Cerf, Bennett's son. So it was kind of good and bad in that Bob Loomis was a very famous editor, and here he was saying, I'm going to publish your book.
Oh.
Also, it meant that since he sent it to Bennett's son, who was rather keen on Bob doing it, that, you know, I kind of had no choice in the matter.
So you signed this contract in 2002 on the basis of all of this constellation of wonderful things falling into place. But you had no idea what was ahead of you, did you? Or
No.
did you?
Once I started, it became clear it was going to be a bigger project than I had imagined. But I really had no idea how big a project it would become.
And I think that's also fascinating for people who write biography because we don't know when we step into it. And you so eloquently describe how this is, it's not just a biography, it's a cultural biography of a period of time that doesn't exist any longer. So how, I know there's no way to distill the last 24 years in a short conversation, but how did you attack the various components of this story over the course of time and wrangle it all? You describe your office. I can't even imagine what it looked like. And the tentacles of people who you chose, you didn't necessarily have to search them out, but the tentacles that you have to wrangle when you write biography.
My editor, Bob Loomis, had been hired by Bennett Cerf in 1957. He was very old when he took the book on already and proceeded to become even older. But he could make some suggestions about people to talk to. Christopher Cerf and his brother Jonathan were both very helpful in opening doors to certain people. The book was not authorized. It was very clear from the beginning it was to be a work of independent scholarship, but they were very helpful. And I began, thank goodness, and I guess this was journalists' training or sense, by trying to find all of the people, the old people who had known Bennett. And even while I was finishing the research thing that I did for the fellowship, I was interviewing people in their mid to late 80s and 90s. There were some people whom I didn't know about and missed, and I could have kicked myself for missing some of them. I was at Columbia, and the Random House archive is huge. And I knew I'd never get through all the boxes. I don't even remember something like 1,200 boxes in the Random House archive. The Cerf archive only had about 80 boxes, so I knew I'd get through all of those. And I realized, why did Cerf matter? He mattered because he made Random House, because of the people he published and how he published them. So I realized I had to go to the authors' archives, wherever they were, the major authors' archives. Unfortunately, there were many major authors. Although there were times when I felt overwhelmed, how am I going to do this? I was never bored, never bored. That helped.
Well, that's right, a necessary ingredient for a project like this, I
Yes,
would think.
yes, yes. And also, it became clear fairly soon that Bennett was someone who did. He did an enormous amount. He was always doing. He absolutely did not waste time. And he said a number of times in writing, that you mustn't waste time. He learned not to waste time. But one of the people I interviewed early on was his confidant. And I only had one long interview with her. But she said something that was so important. She said, "Why does someone do and do and do?" It's because perhaps they don't want to think. They don't want to have to kind of reflect on themselves, because if you're always doing, there's no time for that kind of thinking.
Right.
And Bennett, he kept diaries from the age of 17 until he died. But they were not reflective, they were doing. Only rarely was I able to find something reflective. And that was like gold dust when I found that in a diary or in a letter. And I had to figure out, what was going on in the internal life, because he did have an internal life. He just didn't want to share it. And, why? And I also had to figure out why was someone who did so much, accomplished so much, completely forgotten?
Right. I just want to go back to the first point you made there, though, this idea of how much time you spent. And this is also something that's familiar for biographers, regardless of subject, trying to untangle fact from fiction. You say you
Ah,
spent
yes.
years doing that. And the idea that here was this person who wasn't revelatory in a particular way, but that you had to deconstruct that. I mean, again, I know that's decades of work, but I think that's an interesting theme for people to hear about, that struggle.
The unreliable narrator of his
Yes.
own life. Yes.
Yes.
Bennett did an oral history. And after he died, the oral history was made into a book by his widow and his favorite editor, a man named Albert Erskine, who was Faulkner's last editor. He was Cormac McCarthy's great editor. He was James Michener's editor, Ralph Ellison's editor. So they put together something which they called At Random, which was pretty well known for a while. It was published in the 1970s, about 5 years after Bennett died. Certainly, people in New York, people in books, some people in Hollywood and TV, knew of the book. It was full of stories. But Bennett was very open about the fact that the story was far more important than the fact for him. And he told whoppers regularly. So I had to figure out what really went on. And I discovered early on about the whoppers because he starts the oral history by saying, I am a very unusual specimen. Not only I, but both my parents and all four of my grandparents were born on the island of Manhattan. And when I did his genealogy, of course, I found that three of his grandparents were immigrants, as he well knew.
So at every level, you're untangling fact from fiction.
Yes.
Yes.
I interviewed more than 200 people, and quite a few of them I interviewed multiple times, to try to get to the bottom of things.
How did you keep track of everything? What was your system? And obviously, you probably created and refined systems along the way as
Yes.
technology became better.
Yes, I mean, I do have obviously computer files, but I am looking at eight drawers of filing cabinets, and I've got a bookcase with seven shelves in my study and outside my study, another sort of five shelves. I did files that were individuals, themes, and I also did date files, sort of cross-referencing things.
Both hard copy and computerized, because the computer stuff
Hard
alone.
copy, and then the computer files, they sometimes correspond to the hard copies, but sometimes they do not. There are archives files and there are date files and there are subject files in every chapter. I did an outline, chronological, for everything that would happen in a particular chapter. Chronology was my friend, very much was my friend. You know, there might have been different ways of doing it, but I decided it had to follow, apart from the very first chapter, it had to follow the chronology of his life so that the authors were done according to the chronology of his life, and they, many of them, continued through multiple chapters, which was much, much harder than just doing one chapter about an author.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible weaving and sculpting.
I thought about it in two ways. He was a kind of picaresque character, utterly charming. When he was young, he was very handsome. He was very smart. He was a high school dropout who managed to graduate Phi Beta Kappa from Columbia. He was not an intellectual, but he loved books and he was a real reader, and his instincts for books and people were very sharp. He was mischievous. He was flirty. He was insecure, but projected security. So he was like the hero of a picaresque epic novel. That was one way that I looked at the book. And the other way was, this is like a symphony. And it has different movements. And it has different themes, primary themes, secondary themes. There are transitions, there are cadences. And I have to write and conduct the symphony to get it beyond the climax and to the end. And that's how I thought about it.
How did you know that you were done?
How did I? I'm not sure.
Because at this point, you had this contract. You obviously, I mean, your editor died, Mr. Loomis passed away. So, you know, writers famously miss deadlines, right?
Oh,
But
yeah.
yeah, but so you obviously, it wasn't that you were missing a deadline. You just obviously kept, I assume, extending the deadline.
Yeah, I kept getting extensions. As long as Loomis was alive, I kept getting extensions. At some point, my agent began to get worried that Random House, with Loomis gone, Random House might decide to cancel the contract, because there were a lot of changes at Random House. Not only did Loomis die, but after they failed to buy Simon and Schuster, many of the top executives who actually knew about the book, because it took so long, and also because of my other hat as a journalist who covers the book business, they were gone. And so my agent said, I think we're going to stop asking. We're not going to ask for another extension. You're just going to finish, and we will hand in the manuscript when it's finished. And that's what we did. Now, a big problem, and this existed while Loomis was still alive. I finished, draft, because he'd seen the whole thing. And he'd said for many years, just keep writing, just keep writing. And then he'd said, just keep writing, but it's too long. You're going to have to cut. You're going to have to cut. The cutting started while he was still alive, but he was very old. By then he was in his 90s, and it was slow going. He died, and Random House basically said, this book is too big for anybody in house. It would take up too much time. So you have to work with somebody on the outside. I at first worked with someone who several biographer friends had recommended, who was good. She had a very nice way with a turn of phrase. She really liked the book. She, you know, had read the whole thing before agreeing to take it on, but was having difficulty cutting enough. And we worked together for about a year, and I realized I had to work with someone else in order to cut the amount that had to be cut from the book. So we parted company amicably, and we still are very much in touch. And then I asked several editors to recommend somebody else and began to work with this other person who was able to wield the hatchet as well as the scalpel, as I put it in the book. It was still, I mean, we had disagreements, very strong disagreements about certain things. And I felt, you know, I had to be the person to decide what was staying in and what was going out. So after he'd done his thing, I went through it again and made more cuts, you know, restitched, rewove. And then a friend volunteered to read it. He went through about the first 50 or 60 pages and marked them up and said, "You can get more out. This is how you can do it." And I went through it again and got more out. So it ended up being about 800 odd pages text in the printed book and 200 pages of endnotes and index.
Which, by the way, your endnotes are fantastic and read like a book in itself. They're not extraneous information. I mean, they're that alone is wow.
The endnotes have material that had been in the book and had to be somewhere. Bennett was unreliable, and I had to be as much as I could be reliable. So that's why I felt very strongly about the endnotes.
Yes.
How much was cut out of the book? At least 500 pages, probably more. It took years to do cutting.
What does it feel like now? I mean, you're in chat mode with everybody who wants a piece of you after these terrific reviews. You've got the amazing coverage. It's just you could spend the rest of your life talking about making this book, but how does it feel to wake up and not have to feed that book beast at this point, after living with it longer than some people are married, many people.
It feels very strange.
Yeah.
It's sort of surreal. It's a terrible time to sell a nonfiction book. And, you know, there would have been happier times in which to publish this book. It is so strange to see the book,
Just right to the
this
physical.
big thing there. I am happy that it looks good.
It's beautiful, yeah.
The cover, I fought for that cover, for that photo, because in-house at Random House, they did not want to use that for the longest time through many, many cover designs. But in the end, it was used. And the design of the book is very good. I'm very pleased with that. I wanted Christopher and Jonathan Cerf to see the book in advance. I sent them galleys. Some people thought I shouldn't do that. That's a sort of dangerous thing to do. I'm very glad I did it because they both understood and appreciated the book. And there's good and bad in it. And they accepted that. And that meant a great deal to me. And who knows? I hope I'll be able to write another book. And I hope this book will find its readers one way or another. And I am very glad that I was able to see it through.
That's Gail Feldman, author of Nothing Random, Bennett Cerf and the Publishing House He Built, published by Random House on January 13th, 2026. We spoke via Zoom on March 10th, 2026. I'm Bio member Lisa Napoli. Thanks for listening to Bio.
To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillinganes created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer. And Shireen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.